So welcome their arrival. Welcome to the Zohar on this beautiful, warm Wednesday in Providence. We are continuing with our, we're still in the Ma'amar, the teaching about the night with the bride on Shavuos and Rabbi Shimon's teaching about that. But we've gone through a digression a little bit. We had a teaching from Rav Hamnuna Sava that we started last time. Because Rabbi Shimon got to a point where he said, Ma'ase Yadav Magid Harakia, that the firmament tells of the work of God's hands, Ma'ase Yadav. Get ready to compare this to Ma'ase Yadenu Konenehu, a different verse from Psalms, the work of our hands establish him. But is it our hands or is it God's hands which establish God's presence? We said that Ma'ase Yadav, when we said that they've been quoted this on Ma'ase Yadenu Konenehu in Psalm 90, by contrast, bringing up and said, well, his hands declare, if God's hands declare a certain thing, Ma'ase Yadav Magid Harakia, Ma'ase Yadenu Konenehu, that refers to humans, particularly men here in the gendered sense, and their sexuality, what they said, the covenant, the bris, which is sealed, chotim, in the flesh. That's the sense of, you know, human, because we're talking about on Shavuos night, getting God's flow in such a way to unite in a wedding with Shekhinah, right? To have HaKadosh Baruch Hu Tiferet, or divine energy from above, unite below to bring forth a creative energy that renews the world. That's the sense of it, that brings forth a brighter world, freshens the world, renews the creation a little bit, brings extra creative energy. And what's our role in that? Because we're kind of awkwardly under the chuppah. So our role in that is Ma'ase Yadenu Konenehu, is symbolized by the breach. And in particular, the orla, the foreskin, comes to symbolize the kind of sitra achra, or this extra thing, which isn't essential to that, which kind of latches on and draws energy and kind of represents, in their imagination, a demonic element that sucks divine energy to obstruct creative energy. And so they're very much into the biology of this. So that's where we kind of, that's how we got here. If that makes sense. So now I'll read the teaching again and we'll jump back in. Rav Hamnuna Sava Amar Hachi, Altitin et picha lachti et besarecha, de la yehi farnash pumei, lemete li yahor abisha, So we read that last time. That's where we left off. Rav Hamnuna Sava said as follows: do not let your mouth be induce your flesh to sin. Once we're talking about this, there's this. So we're going to see where this goes. Do not let your mouth induce your flesh to sin. What are we talking about? Spoiler alert: we're going to get to King David and his affairs, literal affairs. One should not let his mouth reach evil fantasies, causing that holy flesh in which the holy covenant is sealed to sin. If he does, he is dragged into hell. The one appointed over hell is named Duma, who is escorted by many myriads of angels of destruction. He stands at the door of hell, but he is not permitted to approach any of those who guarded the holy covenant in this world. So there is this idea that there is an angel, Duma, who is sometimes in other texts just an angel of the afterlife generally, or a guardian of the underworld, but not with a negative connotation. But here, he takes on a demonic valence and is the gatekeeper, the bodyguard, whatever, ticket dude at hell. And Dumas can't touch anyone that remains sexually pure. This is the idea. Now, the name Dumas, I want to say something about this, if that's okay, and then we'll move on. We kind of covered this last time. But the name Dumas, there are different kind of origin theories in the Kabbalah, but the one that's most commonly quoted in sources is that it's related to Domeh, like Mi Domeh Lach, who is like you. They quote that part of the Amidah in the second blessing. And the idea is like this: how do you wind up in hell? Let's summarize the Kabbalistic idea with that question. How do you get yourself stuck in hell? Eternal damnation. Answer is, you think you're like God. You think you're like God. This harkens back to notions of Adam's sin, and we get a concept of, or Eve's, Adam and Eve's sin, original sin kind of again, in that, they are like gods. Right, that's the sense in Genesis, that they now have knowledge of good and evil. And so in some way, they've become like God, knowing things that their innocence is removed for sophistication. And so here, arrogance, in a sense, becomes the main characteristic. If you're trying to summarize the Zohar outside the text, you might say that the version of the is a certain hubris or arrogance causes a person to be domeh, to view themselves as similar to God. But mi domelach, if a past person asks the opposite question, who is like you? No one is like you. Then you come to humility. So that's the usual way that this angelic name is understood. And so assuming that that is true, let's just read that into the text for the moment. Then we get a different piece that it's saying by naming the angel as Dumas, which is that the Zohar is asserting a few things. One, that lost Rabbi Comfort there, that speaking, which is of course a manifestation of thought, which starts up at the top of the spheriotic chart, can be corrupted, and ultimately it's thoughts and speech which lead to action. Actions don't emerge on their own, but come from a process that can be caught earlier, maybe. And also that it's arrogance at the root level of it, if we would kind of work backwards, that is the cause of people thinking they can take sexual advantage of other people. Which brings us right to King David. Okay, that's a great transition. Right? So that's how the Zohar has worked itself up to this place. You might otherwise wonder, like, what does King David have to do with this? So he's the king, and he is involved in a sexual sin that involves taking someone else's wife. So, for people that don't know this story, King David is on the rooftop and sees Bathsheba, a beautiful woman, bathing from his vantage point, high vantage point in the palace. He's kind of seeing what he shouldn't see. And so he sends her wife, her husband, Uriah, the general, into war on a suicide mission to kill him so that he can take her as his wife. So he kills her husband and takes her for himself. Then the prophet Nathan confronts him with an analogy and asks what should be done in this case. There's a guy with one small sheep and someone else with many riches. And, the guy with the many riches takes the one small sheep, and what should happen? And David says, that guy is guilty. And then Nathan famously says, Hatahaish, you are that guy. So that's the story outside. So now let's see how the Zohar treats this story. Now, this is admittedly immediately a problem for the Zohar, because David in the Kabbalah is the paradigmatic representation of Malchut or Shechina. He's the start of this notion of monarchy. He's the king. And so David is divine presence embodied. And so David is a good figure. He's a heroic figure. He's the herald of the Messiah, which is the teaching we're in, is about bringing the Messiah. It's the Shavuot Tikkun, is about bringing the Messianic era by staying up all night, read the entire exile, and turning it into the day or the bright future. So we have to redeem David. So they're really dealing with something much more fraught, which is if David, the dark side of Shekhinah, right? That's what they're dealing with, which is like all of this creative energy. Let me frame it outside. In doing the tikkun, if we relate this back to the tikkun of Shavuot, or in trying to be a Kabbalist or in coming to Wednesday Zohar or whatever, and this might be some of the dangers of Kabbalah that people sometimes warn about. You know, Kabbalah is dangerous. How is it dangerous? This is an actual Zoharic theory of danger. Someone might come to think that in doing these tikkunim and bringing the future redemption, that they have a certain creative power, which causes them not to have humility about the beauty of the world or the order of creation, according to the Kabbalistic statement of it, but they become spiritually arrogant, a huckster of sorts, and then start to abuse that with all kinds of power sins that we know usually, you know, involve sex and money, right? And in this case, you know, a kind of hit on the guy. So this is really not just an expression about King David and what's King David's role, but it's a fear about Kabbalah. Will not all of this, our role in kind of merging with Shekhinah or seeking communion, seeking to bring, will this not all lead us to some kind of lust of religious power, which will cause us to ultimately become, you know, murdering adulterers? Is that not a fear? So that's really the question that's at stake. David Malka Bishaita de Irale. When this happened to King David, when what happened? When Duma, came, right? That's the issue. David Malka Bishaita de Irale, who ovda dachil. Is damnat le bat sheva miyoma de it brayama. Okay, so let's start there. King David, when that incident befell him, was frightened. That moment, Duma rose in the presence of the Blessed Holy One and said to him, Master of the universe, it is written in the Torah, a man who commits adultery with a man's wife. And to your neighbor's wife, there are two warnings not to, and there are others, right? But in the Ten Commandments too, interesting why they quoted these and not others, but don't take your neighbor's wife. Basic ethics here. David, who ruined the covenant by lewdness, what shall be done to him? The Blessed Holy One said to him, no, David is innocent, and the Holy Covenant stands arrayed. What is revealed before me that Bathsheba was destined for him since the day the world was created. Now, this is picking up on a line of apologetics in the Talmud. The footnote in the Mat 392 quotes it. Quoting there, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Rava expended ever since the 6 days of creation, Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, was designated for David, but she came to him with suffering. The school of Rabbi Yishmael taught, likewise, she was designated for David, but he ate her unripe prematurely while she was still married to Uriah. So there's that. And there's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi that we'll get to, who also in the Talmudic tradition, he's a descendant of David and defensive. So the long Talmudic tradition. The first thing the Zohar kind of does is this, look, it's interested in defending David here. There's a long Talmudic tradition of defending David. But here, instead of rabbis defending David, they have God defending David. Which, the plain sense of it, even David himself says, Chatati Lashem, I am guilty before God. So David confesses, but God throws out the confession in a sense. David is innocent, and the Holy Covenant stands arrayed for his real performance. So the first idea is, look, they were destined to be together. Now, this is a pretty radical idea. It's prohibited to do this thing, and it's wrong, ethically, morally, legally, socially. But because there's some greater plan involved, it's okay. But what does that do to law?
Yeah, this is completely weird. But of course, as you're pointing out, I mean, it's built into the whole story that David is this incredibly complex person. That's the nice way of saying it, but a serial sinner, and yet he's the ideal king somehow.
Right. So we're kind of seeing that, right, on the one hand. So Dumas gets into a little, there's like a courtroom battle that transpires here. You could almost imagine this. I think they did imagine this taking place in a court, right? So you kind of have God as both the defense attorney and the judge, and Dumas as the prosecutor. It's good. If you committed a crime, you want God as your defense attorney and judge in one. So Amarle.
Although now Dumas is playing the role of the Satan, which is
Right.
interesting because we have the Satan say in the Job story, but there it's got nothing to do with the Lord of Hell. But this is sounds very much like sort of the Christian idea of angelology related to hell. It's interesting.
Right, there's this right. It sounds a lot more like with a different name, but Satan, overlord of, the hell, comes, right? There is that. Right. But he's playing the role here of the Satan, the accuser.
Right.
Right. Amarle, literally. Amarle ikamif gale kamei la gale. Amarle v'tshuba hetira hava mada hava. Daha kol inun de alav lekrava. Ba'al chad minayu ad de'after beget li itznetei. Being today, Amarle hacha hava leila orcha tlat yarche v'la aurach. Amarle b'mayuki mila ba'alter d'chayshinon dihim me'ubet. Begalei kadamai de'uria lo karif ba'la almen daha shemi chatim begavei l'sahaduta. Tiv uriahu shpi chatum b'hadei de'la shimash ba'la almen. Amarle mar da'alma. Ha'ma de'amarid ikamil galei de'la shchi ba'da uriah. Kame migalei. So, really interesting argument that goes on here in the courtroom. He, Dumas, replies back. If you know that it's destined God, that's fine. But David didn't know that. In his mind, he was sinning. Who cares? That look to his state of mind, the mens rea, in formal legal terminology. He was committing an intentional crime. He said, God replies back. Further, what happened with permission. For all those entering battle, no one would enter until he legally divorced his wife. Look, says God, there was a tradition in the Talmud, don't you know, Duma? The Talmud says that during the time of King David, what happened? Whenever anyone would go to battle, they would write a get, they would divorce their wives before going to battle. And why would they divorce their wives? Lest they die on the battlefield and their bodies not be recovered and their wives be stuck married to them as agunot, as chained. So they would divorce their wives before they left, and hopefully, presuming their wives remained faithful, they'd remarry them upon return. This way, if the worst thing happened, their wives wouldn't be stuck to never remarry again because you need evidence. So it's funny, the reason that there was such a thing is kind of an implicit knock on David. He sends his soldiers kind of callously into battles where they died with such regularity that they started to divorce their wives before leaving. So it's like David, the proof that David didn't sin is itself even in the evidence. So God is taking the evidence against David, which is like he just sends people to go die in battle a little bit callously. And uses that somehow to defend him, saying, now, and I guess in a modern context, it's just worth noting, perhaps as throwing a firecracker into it, but, you know, we're not immune to people taking the same evidence about what happens in battle and military ethics and viewing those in totally opposite ways, right? This is a similar example. So here they view it favorably. David, you know, it's true, but so what happens? Uriah must have divorced his wife first. They must have been divorced. So David didn't really steal the wife because everyone got divorced because David was crazy.
Is this, excuse me, is this a Talmudic tradition that if we want to look at it cynically was like invented to retroactively exculpate David? Does it
So the interesting piece is in the Talmud, it's really not. Yeah, I mean, right. You could say that, especially because the people inventing it are his descendants. I do believe I once went to a lecture where someone quoted ancient rabbis saying that, yes, you shouldn't listen to these opinions, even because they admit their bias. Mm-hmm. They're just defending. You know, people have family loyalties and do what they can to clear the family name, and we get that, but it doesn't have to. Right. So, yeah.
I mean, even if it weren't that, right? I mean, David is such a central figure.
Right, even if it's not descendants of David inventing the Talmudic tradition, like Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, but even in any event, David is so important, you know, mm-hmm. the first united monarchy, that builder of Jerusalem, kind of, that it makes sense to kind of whitewash or excuse. Yeah. I think this invites cynicism. Sometimes cynicism, you know, is unwarranted or excessive. This invites clear cynicism. And they know it, right? Which is why they put it in a conversation with Duma. The funny thing is Duma seems to have the better of the argument. He replied, if so, even if that's true, that it was legal, he should have waited 3 months. And he didn't. Why should he have waited 3 months? In order to clarify the paternity of any child. In other words, Uriah went to battle and died, and he divorced. But, you know, there's this ambiguous period where if a child had been born, we wouldn't be obvious. And so still too in conversions and other things, they do this. They want people to have a waiting period of living, you know, of not being sexually active in order to clarify paternity of future children. And I mean, now we have like genetic tests, a little easier to do. But yeah, then this is as good a way as any, which is to wait. So it doesn't really matter. He didn't follow the law. Says, I mean, he's supposed to wait. That's not what happened here. He said, concerning which case was that rule established? Where we fear she might be pregnant. But it's revealed before me that Uriah never approached her. For look, my name is sealed within him as evidence. It is spelled both Uriah and Uriahu. My name is sealed in him, proving he never cohabited with her. Uriah has God's name in it at the end. You know, it has Yud Hey, and in another version, which actually isn't this Uriah, but that's a separate issue, it has Yud Hey Vav, and Daniel Matin of 395, you know, writes about the other Uriahu, and how those figures got conflated here. I'll speak in a minute about why the Zohar is conflating clearly different figures into one person. There's an agenda, they're not just confused. But in any event, the basic narrative points, just to get the plain text before we delve into the secret code, is that God's name is in Uriah. In other words, Uriah is not cohabit, or another way to look at it is every version of God's name that's in Uriah, if we want to delve a little deeper, Yud-Heh and Yud-Heh-Vav, none of them are Yud Hey Vav Hey. And sex for this is Yud Hey Vav Hey. So let me whiteboard this, you know. I think this is worth whiteboarding. Oh, what happened here? Yud is generally associated with Chochmah. Maybe we know this already, but sorry, with a mouth, it's a little. Hey, the first hey is usually associated with Binah. The Zohar is assuming this here. Vav, which has the numerology of six, is usually associated with Tiferet or Yesod, shaped like a phallus or a spine or a center column. Whoa, bah, I can't draw with a mouse. But also associated with the whole six, Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzach, Chod, Yesod, those six, and the final hay of Shekhinah. So actually the Zohar's point is...
Is it Shekhinah or is it Yesod? At some point I annotated that diagram, put the second hay with Yesod.
The second hay is generally associated with Shekhinah. There are times where it, you know, kind of, it's the merger of the two. Mm-hmm. There are times where it's become Yesod animating Shekhinah or a Yichud of the two. But generally, it's really Shekhinah. Mm-hmm. So this is the most common statement of it. You know, there are variations. So given that, you know, Uriah or Uriahu, you only get either this far or this far, but you never get this far. And of course, Vav and Hey represent sexual relations. So that's the Zohar's point. However you spell, that's God's point here, kind of implicitly. However you spell Uriahu, it's not just it's got my name in it and so I got improved. That's the opposite of everything the Zohar is saying. God is the creative energy of the universe, which manifests in humans as sexual energy in this teaching. But the name of God, sealed in Uriah, is not a name that's complete. Now, another kind of tradition about what's going on here. I'm going to clear this. So this is God's response just in the courtroom dialogue to, you know, this whole piece is to say, you know, they don't have to worry about a paternity measure because Uriah's name shows that he was not sexually active with his wife. And so that's an interesting idea. So what's that about? In other words, is that just a defense? So what's going on mystically in this teaching? We've kind of done... I don't know, it feels like the right place, so I'll just do it. Even though we're still in the narrative and we haven't translated the whole narrative, but let me jump into what kind of traditionally in the mystical version of it is going on here. If we had our sphero chart, which we do, let me shrink it so it's all on the screen. So if we would take Malchut, we can really divide Malchut. You know, so each of these Sfirot are in and of themselves Sfirot, but they're also thought to possess all of the aspects of all of the other Sfirot as subordinate features of this aspect as the dominant feature. So that makes sense. And so in Chochmah, there's, you know, Keter of Chochmah and Bina of Chochmah and Chochmah of Chochmah. All of these have everything of everything. They're all kind of a 10-part unit, just there's a dominant feature. And so in Malchut, you know, David represents Malchut, but Bat Sheva, if you take the lower seven, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, Bat Sheva means the daughter of seven. Literally, it means the daughter of seven. And so part of what the Zohar is teaching here is Bat Sheva is the Malchut Sheva Malchut, as it were, the lower, the feminine of Malchut, the feminine part of Malchut. And David is the masculine part of Malchut. The masculine part is kind of Yesod of Malchut, or maybe it's, you know, like Tiferet of Malchut, but all of, you know, like this idea. David is the phallus of Malchut and Bathsheba. And so they both represent kind of the yin and yang, as it were, of Malchut. And Uriah, Uriah, so literally means the lights of God. The lights are often associated with the Gimel Rishonot, the first three, Keter, Chochma, and Bina, or Chochma, Bina, and Daat, depending on your system. And we said that Uriah, it's not Uriahu, you know, Yod is Chochma and He is Bina. So you kind of have, like, if I could write, which I can, you have like Uriah living up here, the life of the mind. He's a celibate aesthetic. He's also a general. But here a general is not the person that fights, as evidenced by the fact that when he does go to fight, he dies. He's the person who contrives the battle plan, otherwise known as the mind. Where is the mind? So we're now breaking, all these figures are really enacting a cosmic dance in the Godhead. Uriah is the mind, or the lights from above that shine down. But without the Vav, let me just cross that out here. Without the Vav, which is in other versions of the name, he's disconnected from David and Bathsheba below. David is the masculine of Malchut, and Bathsheba is the daughter, you know, below that. So what really what's going on here is Uriah is actually holy. In fact, he's too holy. He's out of this world. He's not real. And so what they're kind of saying is David sends that disconnected intellectual spirituality that isn't embodied. This is a much more complicated teaching. Off to die. That may seem harsh. Wow. This may be a little polemical also. You know, what are they talking about, the classic rabbinic class? Do they have other scholars in mind as Uriah, as pathetic, as, you know, getting played in the real world? Whereas they are working in, you know, the spiritual. And so the David sends Uriah off to the battle to die and takes Bathsheba for himself. He's unifying Shekhinah. So that is part of what's going on with, he's Uriahu. No, he's Uriah. And it's David. And it's Bathsheba. And this argument, and my name is, you know, yeah, that's kind of what's going on. All right, so I just wanted to kind of set that up. We'll go back to the text now.
And the Zohar's point of view is that this story was at one and the same time a historical story with real people, but also a symbolic story, even as it was acted out by real people.
The Zohar seems to have a kind of mythic view of time. You know, it's called mythic time, mm-hmm. which is, and this can be seen even in the Zohar's own, let's take the academic claims at their surface that you have a bunch of 13th century scholars in Spain writing wild new narratives. Some of them based on, you know, loose Kabbalistic traditions or Talmudic traditions, but clearly there's a lot of creativity. This is at best historical fiction, at best, right? You know, they're taking nuggets from the tradition and going all over the place with it on their own accord. And and attributing these things to Tanayim, to Mishnaic scholars, as if it's legitimate. And I don't think they view that as some kind of fraud. They really, I think, did view time as kind of mythic. Like, when did Cinderella happen? Maybe that's like a too trivial way of saying it, but, you know, it's just it's a mythic story. And so, and obviously they view these things as having happened. They didn't have a view of history or historicity, I don't think, at that point. It was either something did or didn't happen. But I don't think they were very caught up in the actual event itself. It was more the Tanakh, or the biblical description of it, was a kind of canonization of its mythic significance as part of what happened. And so the plain meaning, which we might call what happened, is the pshat. But the real meaning for them is not what happened. So it may have happened, and as it but it kind of only happened for them to teach the secret meaning. Like, that's why it happened. Okay. That's the whole important. Yeah. Otherwise, lots of things happen. You know, why write it down? So I think in the Zohar, they really do everything that happens in the Bible as really secretly about the inner life of God. Everything. Nothing is otherwise. I don't know if that's a fair answer.
Well, it's at least an interesting answer.
I can kind of, it's a little evasive. I'll try and refine. Maybe I'll, you know, kind of ask around, like, did they have a view at any point of what's actually happening? And is there something especially important going on at that moment? Or is it just, you know, is this a kind of eternal process that plays out? Or did it happen at that moment?
Well, but the good thing about the answer that you gave is that it applies to more than just this story, but it really applies to everything in Tanakh, right?
Yeah. And they viewed the whole Tanakh as having a realm of secret, and that really the whole Torah, as was this kind of recorded tradition, are names of God encoded in different ways, if only you could figure it out. And so Duma replies to this claim that, look, Orya never slept with her. And I know because of the letters of my name and the kind of plain meaning of that and the secret meaning kind of decoded just beneath the text, which I think is the plain meaning of this. There's a plain secret meaning in the Zohar. The Zohar is self-consciously a cryptic book. So, you know, there's like what it says and there's what it means, but what it means doesn't have to be that far-fetched, if that makes sense. So he replied, I'm just saying what I think I'm saying now is not speculation. I think it's the plain meaning. He replied, Master of the Universe, as I already said, even if it's not, I'll say, even if it's not the plain meaning, it's how the classic Kabbalistic commentators of the Zohar have all understood this text. He replied, Master of the Universe, and most of them had some kind of direct link of oral tradition to the people that wrote the text. So he replied, Master of the Universe, as I already said, even if before you it is revealed that Orya did not lie with her, like, you know that Orya is not, you know, represents this concept. But was that revealed to him? David didn't know that. He should have waited 3 months. Furthermore, if he knew that he never lay with her, why did David send for him and order him to have intercourse with his wife, as it is written? Move this out of the way. Go down to your house and bathe your feet. Go down to your house and bathe your feet. So before David sends him to battle, David tells Uriah, why don't you go spend one last night with your wife? I'm going to send you to battle tomorrow. So it sounds, bathe your feet here is a euphemism. You know, what if David thinks they're not having relations, why does he tell them, have one last night before you go off to battle? So go back to the text. Amar Vaday Lo Yada. Aval yatir mitzvat yarche orech daha arba yarche habu dahachi taninan b'chamisha v'eshim dinisan avar David keroza b'chol Yisrael v'havu in Yoav b'shiva yomen desivan v'azlu v'chabalu ara divni amon sivan v'tamuz v'ad v'elul ishtahu sham v'arba v'eshim b'elul havamada hava mibat sheva u'biyomen dekipurim machalikut shabichu ahu chobah. The Itamri Bizayan Ba Adar Abar Karozov Ikana Shuba Khamesa D Ar, the Khamesar Ba Alu Hava Mada Hava Mibashavu Yomada Kipori Bisar. Gam Hashem Hevir Khatatha Lo Tamut My Lo Tamut Lo Tamut Bida Diduma. So he said, certainly he did not know. David did not know that Uriah and Bathsheba were not having relations at that time, but he waited longer than 3 months. Actually, 4. Yeah, no, says God. Actually, he did wait, you know? For we have this interesting series that keeps defending. So we have this interesting tradition that on the 25th of Nisan, David issued a proclamation throughout Israel telling them to go to war. That's kind of just after Passover. And by the 7th of Sivan, which is either, you know, probably just around after or on Shavuot, probably just after Shavuot, it assembled under Yoav, the general, and they set out and destroyed the land of the children of Beni Ammon, of Ammon. They lingered there for Sivan, Tammuz, Av, and Elul, and then the 24th of Elul happened what happened with Bathsheba. It's a tradition that David sent them to war on the 25th, and he didn't actually sleep with Bathsheba until the 24th of Elul. These are really specific dates. So God actually says, you know, actually, when these things happen, let me tell you when they happened. On the date of such and such, this happened, the date of such and such. Now, this doesn't seem to be cross-referencing anything else we know per se, but it's just, you know, kind of an imagined defense. They lingered there for Sivan, but of course, if we're talking about bringing the, it's not a coincidence that all of the calendar dates here mentioned are just around or just after holidays. They're in the light of the holiday, so to speak. And so that's relevant here. The period from Pesach to Shavuot, when David issues the proclamation to go to war, can be kind of understood as after Pesach, there's this kind of war to bring, you know, the divine light down and in through the Sefirot. And by Shavuot, they'd kind of assembled, you know, to receive the Torah, which is viewed here as a kind of a potrapeg weapon to destroy the children of Ammon. They stay there. 24th of Elul happened what happened with Bathsheba. David sins when? Right before Yom Kippur. There's the time of forgiveness on Yom Kippur. Blessed Holy One forgave him that sin. Now some say it happened like this. Here's the proclamation, not on the 25th of Nisan, but on the 7th of Adar. The 7th of Adar. 7th of Adar is the birth and death of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses. Different kind of tradition. They assembled on the 15th of Iyar. On the 15th of Elul happened what happened with Bathsheba, and Yom Kippur was assured. God has removed your sin. You will not die. What does you will not die mean? You will not die. I think everyone will die. It's one of the death and taxes. Everyone is mortal here, including David. You will not die at the hand of Duma. You'll not die for this. So God says, look, there are two different accounts of the timeline here. But according to either account of the timeline, David waited either 3 months or 4 months. So he's fine. Amar Duma, Mar da Alma. Hamida Khadi itli kabeti ihu aftach pumeva. Amar Cheshem ki ben he Adamar David, Luve Hashem Ezratali Kimat Shochna Duma Napshi, Luve Hashem Ezratali Tahava Apotropostili, Kimat Shochna Mahu Kimat Kehut Daki Kesir de Ipeni Uvain Sicha Achra Kushira Havatala Shachna Duma Napshi. So we'll be back in this next time. But let me read it here through, and we're going to open up with more of it. We'll start going through it. So Duma says, look, God, master of the universe, I still have one thing against him. He opened his mouth and said, as God lives, I swear, I take an oath, the man who did this deserves to die, when Nathan, the prophet, presented him with the metaphor of what he did. In other words, David, when caught in a lie, confessed. He condemned himself. I claim him. I'm going to take him to hell. He confessed. What is this? I'm the prosecutor, and I have a confession. What's with your clever defenses? So Duma is kind of got it, right? And he said, you are not entitled. He confessed to me, saying, I've sinned against God. Even though he did not sin, but as for his sin against Uriah, I sentenced him to punishment, and he received. So we're kind of separating the sin, actually. Duma, so this is a jurisdictional claim. Duma is only empowered to prosecute sexual crimes. And so God says, actually, when he confessed, you see, and he said, this person deserves to die, it wasn't for the sexual sin. It's for the murder of Uriah. This is the sin. But he did with Bathsheba. So it's kind of funny, actually. Because at first, the sexual sin is the thing that's really like a big deal in the Zohar. But now, on a technicality, he's going to get off, right? Like, he's, you know, been charged with second degree murder, you know, or like, we're on trial here for, let's say, adultery and rape. And his confession was for murder. He didn't confess for this. And by the way, I have evidence to show that this sexual crime isn't as bad as it looked at first. In fact, it's justifiable. He was divorced and he waited. Uriah wasn't even sleeping with his wife, implies some extent of which he'd forfeited the marriage rights. And David's not as bad as he looks in this story. If you know what I know, says God, and I'm the defendant and the judge. But as for the murder sin, he's already done the time. There are other punishments for that. And those punishments are that one of David's kids would die. That's what Nathan, you know, says. And also that that his dynasty would be, you know, war torn. His wives would be stolen from him. I mean, it's, but in other words, David is, you know, already been sentenced for that part of it. That's not the trial here. The trial here is for the sex crime, and he's innocent. Immediately, Duma returned in despair to his site. He goes back to hell, to the entrance of hell. Concerning this, David said, but notice, he doesn't go to hell for this. His punishments are all in this world. But eternal life, his eternal life is preserved in this deal. David said, unless God, right, and this is in the song, had been my help, my soul would have dwelt with Duma. Now, Duma nafshi seems to mean my soul would have been silent. Like, without God as my help, I would have nothing. Without God's repentance, God accepting my repentance, what could I say? Unless God had been my help, my apotropos, guardian isn't the right word. I'm going to go with lawyer. Unless God had been my attorney, apotropos. I mean, apotropos is legally someone who is you for legal purposes, right? We call that a power of attorney. So unless God had been my power of attorney, I'm going to go with my attorney or my lawyer in this trial, my soul would have dwelt with Duma. Not my soul would have been silent, but I would have been in hell with Duma. what does kimat mean? So it says, I almost would have been with Duma. Or soon. Almost soon. What does that mean? My thread is fine as a filament of hair separating me from the other side. By that measure, my soul did not dwell with Duma. No, the kim'at, the almost is, I got off on a technicality. That's what David says. You know, like, as if to say in the psalm, all these things God said on my behalf in the defense, like the jury bought it, but it wasn't true. I nearly was convicted, David, but I had God as my lawyer. So that's what the psalm says. Like, if not for God, the most inventive defense attorney there ever was, I would have gone to hell. So we're going to get back to this a little bit. But what are they saying in context of the whole teaching? That arrogance can inspire wicked thoughts, which inspire you, like, lustful statements, which lead to sexual sin, which leads you to destroy or pervert the covenant, which empower the demonic side and send you to hell. And the answer is, God is aware of the temptation. Also, though, right, so the Zohar is playing both sides, and is also understands the human temptations and lust, and is, yeah, ruining the covenant is ruining the covenant, but it's more complicated here. If you are David, which is, if you are really uniting the Shekhinah, if you're playing with fire, so the Zohar is talking about, it's defending its own project. If you're playing with spiritual fire, but really uniting God or bringing God into the world, but living on the risky side and maybe crossing the line sometimes. But if you're really doing it, God might defend you when you cross the line. It might get you off on a technicality. In other words, you're like that kid with the rich uncle connected to the judge. That's what it's saying here. So, we'll get back to this next time. I think this is a very provocative passage, or we're going to put this in context. But we'll come back. So,
I have an outside of the Jewish tradition question. Does anyone know about the link of this wonderful story to the Faust story? Because it's a lot.
Yeah. That's a great question. I'm sure someone does. I am going to ask.
Okay, great.
I'm going to ask rabbinic colleagues and put it out to a rabbinic list server too.
Okay, fabulous. I would love to know the answer if you learn one.
Yeah. So that'll conclude where we are today. You know, we still have more of this story. We'll get to next time, but I hope okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi. Take care.
Have a good day.
Bye.